Welcome to Nicosia Uncut. In this episode, we are very happy to have a special guest, Fiona Mallen, director of Sapienta Economics and producer of Figure It, which is an Island Talks program. So we have been thinking of looking at the current state of play with the Cyprus problem and the new process that is slowly emerging. And we would like to discuss with Fiona and Kemal, of course, what it is that we can do in order to make the process a success this time, and what aspects we need to look more into if this is our desire. So, Kemal?
Thank you, Andromahi, and welcome, Fiona. We know that the process has been stalled since the failure in Crans Montana, and I think this is the first real attempt since the appointment of the new United Nations envoy to the Cyprus problem. And, you know, so far we have always been discussing Cyprus problem as a process of a comprehensive solution, as a big bank solution, which is kind of finalized with two referendums on both communities. And it seems that this hasn't been working successfully. And recently you have published some suggestions to make it more incremental. Would you like to share with us your opinion on that, especially taking into consideration the fact that making a comprehensive solution seems to be very difficult at this stage?
Yes, yeah. Okay, hello. Hello, both of you. So I think what is the challenge of the comprehensive settlement, as it's been known, is there's two parts to it. One is what I call the Big Bang approach, and the other is the leader-focused approach. Regardless of what it's been called, that's actually what it is. So what do I mean by Big Bang is, because of concerns of the Greek Cypriots, you've always had this approach where if in the Annan plan and if we'd got there with Crans Montana, the midnight of the day of the referendums, everything would be implemented legally from day one. So the power sharing starts from day one. And a double problem for the Greek Cypriots was that the security aspects are implemented gradually. So, but it's a scary prospect anyway. The two sides have not lived together for, you know, 60 years. And yet you've got this solution where suddenly everybody has to live together and share power on day one. So the Greek Cypriots currently have a real issue with that because they're worried about the continuation of the Republic of Cyprus. So somehow you need to get around that and get them comfortable with approaching it differently. And then the other aspect is this leader-focused approach. So you ultimately have two guys, potentially three guys if you accept that Turkey is very consequential in whatever happens. Three people, elected people in a room with all of the burden of the decision-making on them, and one of those always will have an election coming. So and we've got that right now. Everybody's telling Olgin, oh, you can't do anything because we've got March elections in local elections in Turkey. Oh, you can't do anything till June because the Greek Cypriots have got local elections. Oh, but then Tatar might face re-election in April next year. So it's you need to find a way of, and it's not removing the power from the leaders, it's sharing that burden so that the people who voted for them can also, in a way, support them in these what are ultimately always going to be really difficult decisions.
And what is your suggestion? I mean, how we know that the United Nations has been proposing to involve the civil society, making sure that women participation is ensured are ensured. So what to do? I mean, there is a lot of discussion on that, but how are we going to make sure that what you have suggested will become a reality?
Mm-hmm. So it's not actually my idea. It's other people's ideas. But the general approach is that, well, before we even get to how do we bring people in, I think you need to change the question. So the question we have at the moment, or rather the aim at the moment, is bizonal bicommunal federation, or BBF for short, which I think post-Crans Montana is a straitjacket, not just for the Turkish Cypriots, but for the Greek Cypriots as well. It's kind of limiting how you reach a negotiated settlement. You know, what do we want? We want peace on this island. And we need to do that in a way that's viable and long-lasting and isn't just a solution insisted upon by one side or the other. So you can't also just say, let's have two states just because Turkey says so. That's also not viable. And it's not even going to improve Turkey's security if we get to where we're actually heading. So let's say if this current, not even a process yet, fails, where are we heading is a hard border on the Green Line with a either de facto or de jure annexed Northern Cyprus. That's not secure for Turkey. It will still have to have troops on the island and so on, and you know. So how do you find...
If you allow me here, it is not secure for the international community either and for the EU either, which is something that I think is often missed. Yeah.
So what I'm suggesting, and it could potentially even, I didn't write this in the article, but it could potentially even be a new Security Council resolution that says we mandate a new process of what we call deliberative democracy. So that's bringing in, and it's not just, I deliberately didn't use the word civil society because in Cyprus that's associated with, you know, people like us. It needs to be general cross-section of society voters, all views. So a deliberative democracy process where you deliberate on these very, very difficult questions. It takes months. You have to put a lot of money into it. I'll talk about that more in a minute. But what would the UN Security Council resolution say is we mandate a deliberative process which has the aim of a negotiated settlement that leads to long-term, whatever, reduction of security risks on the island and in the region, something like this. And why do you need a new resolution? I realise that none of these 17 steps which I proposed could be supported by the international community at the moment because they don't have the words bizonal, bicommunal federation in them. So, for example, the EU couldn't possibly, certainly the EU financial aid regulation, a task force of the Turkish Cypriot community, I'm pretty sure they wouldn't be able to support anything that didn't have the words reunification in it. So, so maybe, I don't know, it's difficult. It's a hard sell for the...
But the question, Fiona, why should the leaders who are currently engaged with it be willing to share power? Why should they be willing to delegate some of the responsibilities? I understand that we are asking the Security Council to task the sites with this responsibility. But will it be acceptable to the sites, will the leaders, to create structures to, you know, like deliberative democracy structures so that they get engaged?
Right now, no, they wouldn't, because they would view it as being scary and losing power. So that's why I said you need to do it really, really slowly in very small steps. So... And this is where, you know, at which stage might you get a different resolution? I don't know. It might have to be further down the line. But the idea is that you start very small with basically people who on the island who are sort of Cyprop geeks and so on to brainstorm
like us
how you might approach the process. Yeah. And people go, oh, but that's going to be the usual suspects. You say, yes, that's just the first step. And it's only because your regular Cypriot doesn't engage in this kind of thing. So, but you, both of you, understand the sensitivities of each of your communities and the other community, and you understand what all of the questions are on the really difficult. So you start with that, a sort of brainstorm. Then you can bring in, there's loads of international expertise now on either elected assemblies or citizens' assemblies or constitutional assemblies. You get some feedback from them. I think the next step you'd have to go to focus groups so that then you do start to get some input from more general vote, you know, general public, as I call it, rather than civil society. Then you have to take it back to the leaders to say, look, this is what they're saying, blah, blah, blah. So each step you have to find ways of reassuring the leaderships on both sides and the political parties and everyone else involved that this is not going to take ownership away from them. It's a way of helping them to make those really difficult decisions. And I think it's worth emphasizing, you know, I was at the table when it was Christofias Talat, because I was working full-time for the UN. Even those two who were officially pro-solution, they couldn't, there were some decisions they couldn't take and still have not been taken to this day, because either they had an election coming or they depended on hardliners, et cetera, et cetera. So any leader, whatever their political stripe, needs some kind of support. You know, it's like knowing that the public is behind you when you're making that really difficult decision. And at the moment, all they have in their ear is the loud no vote. You know.
Well, so but if you think about it here, like you put the whole burden on a single person to carry the burden of, you know, I am bringing the solution, mm-hmm. and while in the way that you are suggesting, it is like you are enhancing the legitimacy of the actions of the leader himself. So it is like you are sharing this burden. It is you are all in this together, and you are trying to do this. There is this emphasis on a single person, which, if you think about it, is a tremendous responsibility, is being lifted in this way. And this is how democracy should be, handled at times of such important decisions.
And it's also much more, it's just what voters expect these days. You know, the current process is over half a century old and it keeps failing. So we have to do something different. The UN has been trying to add in, you know, civil society and so on, but doing it that way, it's incredibly slow. Like, still, the Technical Committee on Gender Equality, you know, they finally were allowed to produce their proposals. I don't think any of them have been implemented yet. You will still be here in 100 years if we do it that way. So it has to be this completely different approach, but the work that the international community needs to do is persuade the leaders that actually this is going to be good for them, because it will end in a negotiated settlement that will reduce security risks on this island, and that's good for absolutely everybody.
I mean, it is not rocket science, and I think it has been discussed, as you rightly pointed out, in the past, to engage and involve the civil society, the assemblies, the citizens, different groups, so that in fact, they will work in a positive way that will be supporting their leaders and taking the big burden or sharing some burden off their shoulders. And and we also understand that the UN is actually is also willing. And I think it's important that the academicians, the researchers, the Cyprop geeks will maybe speak out those more, so that maybe sometimes some people will take, you know, more care in this. But currently there is also a process, Fiona Andromahi, and we know that Olguin is trying to find to see if there is a common ground for the resumptions to start for the talks to resume. And how are we going to see this process accepting and embracing what you've just suggested? What are the mm-hmm. challenges for Olguin to be successful and making sure that, you know, the process actually becomes more involving?
First, let me just take one step back for people who might not understand what a deliberative democracy process is. So let's say one version of it is it would be like a very expanded jury service. So you're a citizen, a voter. It has to be a cross-section representative of society. So it can't only be, I mean, obviously not only Greek Cypriots or only Turkish Cypriots, but it has to be cross-section of education, of social status, etc., etc., etc. You need to make sure you have minorities represented and so on. And then these people, they can be potentially elected. So you can have a situation where, like in Northern Ireland, you had the political parties were elected to this assembly, but then you had deliberate space left for other groups, like there was women's groups in Cyprus, you might want displaced people's groups and so on. And then they deliberate. They might be paid to do this because it's a big job, over several months where they get experts coming in and debating all of the issues, well, presenting all of the issues, and then they sit down together and try and work out the difficult questions. So for me, they would not only do all of the 6 points of the Guterres framework, they would also work out how should we have a referendum, at what stage should we have it, what should the question be, and so on. So that in the end, they basically just present the leaders with, look, this is what we representatives of both sides have come up with. Give us, you know, can you now endorse it, you know? So, so going back to your question, I think the risk with Olgin at the moment, first of all, she's only got, you know, if the Turks and Turkish Cypriots insist on her only having 6 months, and if nobody wants to do anything until after the Greek Cypriot elections on the 6th of June, then that means she's got like 6 weeks to do anything. And so if the focus is on trying to squeeze out yet another confidence building measure, CBMs for short, then I think it would be a great loss of opportunity, put it that way. So what I'm hoping is that she will also be looking at, is there a way we can redesign the process to be more, or to reach our end goal, which is we want to reduce the risk of conflict on this island. But I don't know whether she has enough time. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's a hard sell to get all of the leaders and the governmental powers on board for this. So
the problem with this at the moment, sadly, is the fact that, you know, especially you look at the Republic of Cyprus and the president is becoming increasingly weak. The support of parties around him is increasingly challenged as well. You see that he's being pushed by all directions. He doesn't have the support of the sea of the Democratic Rally as he had hoped for. And this makes it even more difficult for anything groundbreaking to be put forward or to even be embraced, especially if you look at the way the DIKO, the Democratic Party, is going, which is totally towards a much more rejectionist stance, a much more explicitly rejectionist stance, rather, even in the pretense of taking initiatives on the Cyprus problem with other parties. But this kind of goes to show that the Greek Cypriot political parties are lacking in inspiration about the process. And I am very curious as to the extent to which they would ever be open to any groundbreaking or out-of-the-box ideas. And yeah, I don't know about the Turkish Cypriot parties, Kemal, but
I think the Turkish Cypriot parties are understanding that the Turkish Cypriots are not being a real player anymore since the election of Mr. Tatar. And I think they're trying to focus on internal matters, trying to prepare themselves for the upcoming leadership elections and making sure that their parties are getting enough votes to sustain a role in the Turkish Cypriot politics. But the moment they see some possibility, I see that the Turkish Cypriot opposition will be engaged again, but I don't think that they're seeing it yet.
But and in any case, though, the idea that Fiona is putting forward could shake things up in a process that seems to be in a deadlock. Rather, I mean, at least it could inject something new. It could inject something else to discuss rather than same old, same old.
I mean, so just a little bracket here. As we mentioned, the Turkish Cypriot political life, we know that I think not everybody is speaking it like every single day openly, but I think everybody seeing the Turkish Cypriot opposition leader Tufan Erhurman as the next challenger for the Turkish Cypriot leadership role. And now that we have TDP electing a new leader who was quite successful in the last local elections in Kyrenia. So I see that the Turkish Cypriot, and then there is an ongoing corruption scandals when it comes to the diplomas of the Turkish Cypriot universities. And so I think the Turkish Cypriot parties will find it difficult to focus their attention on the Cyprus problem unless there is a real prospect, like maybe a Security Council resolution. And probably they will also be pushed by the labor unions, by their groups, by this who are Cyprus problem geeks.
Mm-hmm. I think, but going back to what Andromache says, it's because of Elam that Vico's going further hardline, right? They're doing very well in the.
Yeah, they have
opinion polls.
They have overtaken Vigo in the polls. They are now the third party, Elam.
Mm-hmm. So this goes to the question of how might you get, if it is considered as shaking things up and therefore scary, which it is going to be scary for doing something different. What can the international community do to try and bring the leaderships here and in Turkey and so on board? And I think that is going to be my next article, actually, is you need some very strategic carrots to be waved at Cyprus, both sides. But, you know, if you do this, then you are going to become geopolitically much more important in X. You can't just throw money at it, I don't think. It's got to be, especially Greek Cypriots need to think that if they do this, they're going to be super important center of the Eastern Mediterranean, blah, fill in the blanks. I don't know what that center of Mediterranean thing is. But you can already see this is something that Greek Cypriots want to do anyway. This whole Gaza Marine, you know, maritime corridor thing is about that as well. But it's what the US has done with Greece. Greece finally, even under the previous government, said yes to the North Macedonia name change, etc. And as a result, they've got carrots all over the place from the Americans. And it was clearly understood beforehand, you can tell in retrospect, that they were offered all of these goodies if they sorted that out and let Macedonia into NATO. So what can, and I think it has to be the EU this time, what can the EU offer Cyprus its equivalent that makes the Greek Cypriots think, okay, it's worth taking this risk to try and do things differently.
And Turkey is just waiting like a reward, like somebody offers me something?
There's already this strategic dialogue with Turkey about what, you know, there's a whole bunch of carrots they're lining up for Turkey as well. But the risk is that is being, certainly from a Greek Cypriot point of view, the risk is that that's being decoupled from the Cyprus problem. But actually, you probably still need to link it, otherwise otherwise, we lose this opportunity.
The question now is the extent to which the international community and the parties that you mentioned, basically, because the international community is not a single thing. But I mean, at least the EU or the US and maybe even Britain. I mean, but especially the EU, I would like to focus a bit more on the EU. Are they aware, keen, interested to play a significant role in this? Are they keen to engage in a way that they will also put their own credibility at stake, let's say, in trying to bring about some sort of progress or resolution? Or do you think that they will choose to remain a bystander? And I am saying this because there has been so much talk about money laundering in the south and the Russians, and after the sanctions and everything, Cyprus has really done a good job at that. But the thing that we don't discuss so much is that basically this situation has moved to the north of the island. So there is this black hole in the north currently where you see all these things that we used to see in the south to have moved to the north, including all the mafia and everything that comes from Turkey, etc. So my question is, if this is the situation, then it directly impacts the EU. And one would have expected that the EU would have opted for a stronger role in this. But they haven't done it yet. I mean, aside from their support to the negotiations and presence in the negotiations. So What do you think about this?
Yeah, it's the million euro question, so to speak.
That was the title of our previous podcast regarding
was
the.
It?
Yeah, we questioned what the end game of Miss Olgin and $1 million question.
I think the EU, I don't think it knows what to do at the moment. That's my assumption. And of course, the EU is a many-headed hydra. You've got the European Council, the European Commission, the European Parliament. At the moment, it's sort of by default put in a kind of technical support role. So that's the European Commission, mainly through the task force in the north. They're doing lots of good work on Halloumi and trying to get this bicommunal solar plant going. But in my view, you need something council-led, and then that gets you round all of the you need it much higher up, because you need those people talking to the Americans, assuming we've got a geopolitically engaged US presidency from next year, which is another risk. That's another reason why the EU needs to wake up and pay attention. But it's not just, you know, it's, so for the EU and the US, it's not just the risk of money laundering, terrorist financing moving to the north, or being in the north. It's also, this whole area has a whole bunch of conflict risks and so on, and it just makes it a lot worse if you've still got an unresolved Cyprus problem. So, yeah, that's the kind of job I would hope Olgin would be doing, and I'm glad she's actually visiting Brussels as part of her things. It's not just the guarantor powers, because they do have a strategic interest in Cyprus, even if they might not yet realize it. We don't know.
Let's talk a bit about the famous energy saga. And Fiona, you've been recording a few podcast energy series. We know that what's being fed to the public do not necessarily reflect the realities on the ground. And then there is also a lot of discussion that the energy will bring certain advantages to certain groups in the equation. How do you see this?
First thing is, it's another reason why you can't wait on the Cyprus problem. Like you have both said many times, the status quo is not static. And what we're facing pretty soon is that it's pretty likely, it seems, based on the last podcast I did with someone who is engaged with it much more closely than me, that Eni will be producing gas from this Kronos reserve, potentially as early as late 2026, and if not 2027. They're quite determined to do it. They've got a market. They know, you know, Egypt will buy it and so on. And if you get to producing gas and you haven't got any deal with the Turkish Cypriots about revenue sharing, which the international community, especially the Americans, have made clear that it should be a shared resource, and if you haven't got some kind of deal with Turkey, then all hell will break loose. And, you know, that's not to defend what Turkey might do, but that's just a fact. It's going to happen. So you have to do something on that. And what I was hoping was you could have, I've even got a map of how it would look like, a grand deal on energy where Egypt gets something, Greece gets something, Cyprus, Israel, Turkey, everybody gets something. But the war in Gaza's made it all rather more difficult. So I think that is really hard sell now, especially anything to do with gas. You might get something with electricity, where at the very least, Turkey doesn't interfere with the interconnector coming from Greece, the electricity cable, and the Greek Cypriots don't interfere with the electricity cable that Turkey wants to send to northern Cyprus. So then all of a sudden, the whole of the island is connected to the European grid. That might be the best you can hope for at this stage.
So I have heard the need to make the solution process incremental. I heard the need for the internationals and for the United Nations to come up with a solution to engage people more. I heard the need for Ms. Olgin to come up with specific outcomes so that we can see that there is some sort of a success, and then that would involve the EU as well. I have heard the need to use energy as a catalyst. I mean, this is not the first time we've been hearing this, but it continues to be the case. So that's why people continues to repeat it. The only thing that I would like to hear more is the local developments on the ground. We now have the European Parliament elections. We know that Andromache is also running with Volt. But we also hear a lot of discussion about Elam sending one representative to the European Parliament. And maybe what are the risks and what are the chances? Is it really a reality? Is it really a possibility? Or is it just that everybody's trying to scare the waters?
I think we should throw that question to Andromache.
Right? I was about to respond. It is a certainty. What are you talking about, Kemal? No, I do not think that there is anything that can reverse the course of Elam in these elections. I think they are going to be the third party most probably, and they have acquired a legitimacy in the political scene that is pretty impressive. But of course, this is the result of the political system trying to kind of go along with their agenda. So this is how they became legitimized, mm-hmm. because the other political parties engaged in their agenda and they tried to adopt it themselves, thinking that they would steal it away from Elam. But obviously, as it happens all the time, and we've seen it happening across all of the European Union, the one that gets strengthened in the end is the extreme end.
And yeah, it's like no one's learned from the UK and Northern Europe that if you have this fringe party that seems to be climbing in the polls and then you adopt all of their policies, all you do is lose votes to them. Nobody in Cyprus seems to... Well, half that's the problem. Well, I don't think the politicians pay attention to what happens in the rest of the world.
But at the same time, I think it is important to acknowledge that Elam's rise should not be a surprise. Elam has had the support of some mainstream media. It has had the support mm-hmm. of the church. It has had the boost by the political parties in the way that I described it before. It has the boost from the educational system itself, which is mm-hmm. in fact based a lot on a very nationalistic agenda, which falls in line with Elam's agenda if we are to look at the issue crudely. So there shouldn't be any surprise about this development. The real question should be, how do we change the course in the bigger picture? Because mm-hmm. this development has repercussions on the relationships, and it will have repercussions on our relationships with the Turkish Cypriot community in mm-hmm. itself.
I see two ways of reversing the rise of Elam in the upcoming next election, which will be taking place on the 9th of June. One is if we see the mainstream parties mobilize their masses to go to the ballot boxes, including DC and AKEL. And two, engagement of the Turkish Cypriots. I'm not sure if the polls are measuring the engagement of the Turkish Cypriots. If the Turkish Cypriots massively engaged and then go to the polls, and I think, I'm not sure, I don't know the latest polls, but there is a chance that this can be reversed.
And remind us all how to register.
Well, basically, there are multiple organizations who are promoting this in the Turkish Cypriot community, including the Human Rights Platform. The European Union-supported InfoPoint project, as far as I know, will start to promote how to do it. Different from the Turkish Cypriot elections, you need to register first. And you just need to go, and then I'll just paste the link under this podcast where they can go and check if they're registered already, if their names are there, and if not, what to do. Human Rights Platform in the Turkish Cypriot community are also helping the interested people to register. So I think it's very important for the Turkish Cypriots to register, not only to stop Elam, but also to become an actor again, to show that they are engaged in this process, mm-hmm. to show that the mainstream political parties must take the Turkish Cypriots into consideration. Because there is this game, on one hand, you treat Turkish Cypriots as if, okay, you're part of the Republic of Cyprus, we do not, you know, they're part of our govern, but then on the other hand, you treat them differently, and then you try to address, you don't even try to address their questions. So I think it's one way of showing that the Turkish Cypriots are part of the Cypriot ground and the Cypriot elections, and they need to do this. And this is what I also advocate. We know that there are also Turkish Cypriot candidates these days. And I don't like to see this as a Turkish Cypriot should only vote for Turkish Cypriots. I think it is important that they listen to the candidates and they pay attention to what they want and what is the best for the country and vote accordingly. But most importantly, they need to get engaged. They need to register and they need to go and vote.
So your next podcast, both of you, should be some practical tips on how you register to vote depending on which community you're living in and so on and so forth, so everybody knows how to get out and vote.
We take note of this.
The deadline is the 2nd of April, and which is 2nd of April is the closing of the lists. But yeah, I also agree with Kemal on the need for Turkish Cypriots to envision their presence in Europe, in the European Union, in a way that goes beyond the Cyprus problem in itself. And obviously the Cyprus problem is a very significant part of it, but at the same time, the cultivation of the European conscience in the Turkish Cypriot community should be a priority. And it would be good to see it developing in the course of these elections, and to see it with the hopefully a good participation from the Turkish Cypriot community.
What's the, coming back to the Cyprus problem before we close the maybe the program, what's the next steps as far as we know when it comes to Ms. Olgin? We know that she visited the capitals and that she was going to come and visit Cyprus again. So do we have a rough understanding of what's next when it comes to her mission?
Not specifically. I just know that she's coming back again to the island. So, but, you know, I think they're deliberately keeping it quiet, whatever conversations she's having. So, okay. Which is probably good at this stage. My assumption is that everything which the British High Commissioner said is in public is what Olgin said in private. But that's only a guess.
No, I think,
you know,
I agree with you.
It was tough messages for both sides.
No, I agree with you there. I think, I believe that the UK High Commissioner had given then a good overview of the current state of play as to how the international parties that are involved in the current process view the situation. I think, to be honest, we had discussed it, Kemal, that I had spoken with Olgin at that coffee at Buchan, but there I had actually asked Mrs. Olgin if she plans to meet people that are against the solution, people that are against the bi-zonal, bi-communal federation, because I do feel that it is important to kind of engage with such organizations as well. And she did say that she intended she would do it in the course of her visits in Cyprus. And I think that that is something significant, just like her experience with the Colombian process, as we have discussed in our previous podcast.
I do know, I think she's talking to more business people this time. So,
Yeah, and on that note, yes. We know that 2024 is the anniversary, 60th anniversary of the AMFISIP arriving to the island. It's the it's the 50th anniversary of 1974. It's the anniversary of 2004 Annan Plan. 4444. I'm not a numerologist or anything like this, but I think we will be seeing some movement in the coming months, positive or negative. But you know, the developments in Gaza and Ukraine, some people claim that it distracts the international community to show more attention on these areas. But in my mind, it is these are the developments which proves that we need to settle Cyprus problem once for all. The other day, I saw some road signs, no, some banners. Some organizations were paying so that they showed the photos of Gaza, and they said this could be the photo of Kyrenia, this could be the photo of Nicosia, trying to remind people the urgent need to solve the Cyprus problem. And I think this continues to be the case. We will continue to voice the reason as much as voice the reasonable thing to do as much as possible. And these are my last words for the episode. I don't know if anybody wants to make final additions.
No, it has been a pleasure to discuss with Fiona. And just to tell our audience that this is actually what we do. I mean, this is how we have fun as well. We just recorded it this time.
Fiona?
I was going to say something crude about what is, if that's what fun is, then what does that mean about us? But
thank you very much for being part of this podcast, and that's all for today.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks, open, diverse, free.